Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 127, being recorded on the 11th of May, 2016, with special guest Neil McKenzie. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest, Neil. So, good to have you back, Kale. How was the conference? You won the conference last week, weren't you?
Yeah, we did. We did a conference, and then like the weekend before that, we had that big hackathon there at the Microsoft office in New York.
That's right. How did it go?
No, it was good. We had a good turnout. We had, I think there was somewhere around 110 people there, and we had about I don't know 20-ish projects come out of it.
What's the one that you thought was not necessarily the like the best example of how to use blockchain, but the one that you thought was just geekily cool?
I think the IoT ones were really cool. They had one for like traffic lights that used a blockchain. That was kind of interesting. I'm not sure the use case 100% for that, but there was a lot of cool ideas that people would come up with. But I think it was a whole variety, not just financial. It was around how to enable like business type scenarios. IoT devices seem really cool because you have this external component like phones and things involved.
Yeah.
Proof of like phone, proof of identity, where you could kind of use like a multi-factor with a blockchain to kind of validate, hey, my name's Kale, and here's three pieces of things that validate I am Kale, and then that can be put on a blockchain and valid and, you know, be immutable and that kind of thing. Those were really interesting.
I know I got a couple of my favorites. Anything in particular that jumped out at you?
Yeah, I think the one about the, I think you had put it in there, it was around the Canada announcement.
Yeah.
And then there's, I guess we've made the announcement about the expansion to South Korea as well. So that's out there now. We've made that thing today. It's on the blog today.
Oh, I missed that one. So.
Yeah, I don't think that's done. It's announced, but I think it's not something that's built or anything yet. But
okay.
But the Canada one, yeah, 0365 is up there now. So
yep,
it's cool.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Yeah, the one that jumped out at me, and again, just being a support person, right, is the migration from Classic to Resource Manager is now in preview, right? So you can take your Classic resources and VMs both in and not in a VNet. There's a number of limitations, right? You can't have gateways. You can't have some other things. So migrating these resources from Classic to Azure Resource Manager, you know, we're adding new features to Resource Manager stuff. We're not adding new features and functionality to Classic resources. So this is really, you know, if you need and want the latest and greatest, you know, definitely look at you know, doing this. It's not GA yet, so there's still some kinks to be worked out. But
I'm not familiar with that, Evan. Is that a series of scripts or is it something like that, or how does that actually?
So it's a mix. So there are some scripts along with basically some underlying platform capabilities to make this happen. And there is, you know, there are, like any other kind of hardcore migration, there are some gated steps where, hey, if you go past this point, it's like the point of no return.
Yep.
You know, so I'm still kind of learning all the ins and outs of this, but this is really about helping customers get to our latest and greatest stuff without necessarily having to rebuild all your stuff manually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to take some of that load off of you.
Cool. One that sticks out with me too, that I've actually done some work with is the test drive feature, for the Azure Marketplace.
Yeah.
So we have an option there now. So basically if somebody's, doesn't have an Azure account, brand new, just coming into the space, and they just want to try something basically for free for a determined period of time that's kind of short, they could actually go up there and kind of kick the tires on stuff, and it's called Test Drive, and we actually have a bunch of them up there right now, so we have some links. You can go up and look and try them out, and it's basically all pre-configured, all ready to roll. You click through a couple things, and it'll provision it for you, and you can take a look at it.
Yeah, I think I agree. I thought that caught my attention as well, because that's the thing I hear from customers. Hey, I want to try filling the link, but I really don't want to pay for it yet. Okay, get it, right? But now they can kind of do that for free. So.
So what, anything else that's cool this week?
Those are the big ones for me.
What about that SQL stuff, Evan? I thought you'd be
Oh
already
yeah, the
there.
Elastic set. Yeah, the Elastic Pool's going GA. I mean, I guess I don't know. Maybe I'm starting to get jaded, but stuff going GA is absolutely key from a kind of a support for customers, and that changes the support model. But I don't know about you guys, but I'm seeing more and more people that are kind of recognizing that even our non-GA services we treat pretty seriously, right? As far as not breaking compatibility and keeping them up and that kind of stuff. So I'm seeing more and more people leverage things that are in kind of public preview. So I'm it, yeah, it didn't catch my attention as much that it went GA because I, hey, Elastic Pools, they're there, they're cool. So, but yeah, that is GA now at this point.
I think the
Excellent.
last one I had, to your point, Sujeet, was around the CDN announcement around Akamai. So we now have that offering in the portal as well. So we have, basically different types of CDN networks that we can use there now, and Akamai is the latest one. So you can check that out. It's in the portal right now.
Right, and it's integrated into the portal, I believe, right? The
That's correct.
settings, etc. So that's nice. It's a good partnership with them. Okay. I guess we'll get to our special guest, Neil. Neil McKenzie. Neil's a cloud solutions architect, I believe, at Microsoft, and he's been involved with Azure for I think ever since it came out. I get the feeling. But Neil, can you give our listeners a slightly better introduction about your background, please?
So I guess in 2008, I was thinking of starting to look at the cloud. AWS was coming up, living in San Francisco, cloud's kind of everywhere at that point. So I was actually going to look at EC2, but pretty much the day I was going to start, they did the big announcement at PDC 2008 of Azure. So being more in a Microsoft stack guy, started looking at that. There wasn't much to it at the time, it was just basically compute. There's a lot of live framework, a lot of stuff in the live mesh side of things that's gone now. It doesn't exist anymore. A lot of stuff has gone over the years. SQL database wasn't there. There was an early version of it was similar to Azure Tables, except it used WCF instead of REST, and that lasted about 4 months in public before it was
You're
burst.
talking SQL Server Data Services, right, Neil?
Yeah, that one. Yep.
Yeah. Yep, I remember those days.
Like three people know how to use it, and
Yes.
so got in pretty early, to be honest. There was at that time there was no documentation. There was a fairly small number of people.
I
Early
can't
days of
hear.
PaaS cloud services were fairly bleak. There was things like no debugging capability. It took 20 minutes to deploy something. So it's been a big change when IaaS coming out in 2012 made a big difference. Opened up a lot of workloads for us, and that really opened up a lot of avenues. Just having that IaaS announcement, it was a great party as well in San Francisco, and we put on a good party when we have good announcements. Took over an entire city block and had a street party for the announcement.
That's
And
good. And that's good. And it's nice to have someone who has that kind of background and experience in Azure since day one. I think I know Evan, you've been also with it from the start, right? I believe.
yeah, I was going to say I very much remember the release at PDC because while we were on stage announcing, and I can't remember the customer that it was, I was on the phone with that same customer because they were having trouble with SQL Azure. Like as we're announcing it, they're on the phone with me behind the scenes going, "Great, the service has been GA, has been publicly announced for like 2 hours, and I'm already on a CVE case with it." So it is much, much better than that these days, no question. So, yeah.
Sorry, Neil. And then, yeah, so you were saying after that. So, what have you been doing after that with Azure then? Like, what's your history
Yeah.
with?
So around about that time, I think it was 2011, I wrote a book, or 2010, I wrote a book in Azure, a cookbook thing that's been taken over by someone else for the second edition. And then I was contracting to DX for a long time, and to, I guess, DPE at the time, helping customers get onto Azure and helping them understand Azure, especially through that IaaS 2012 period when it was brand new. So I ended up work sort of about half time in DX, helping customers get on. So like people like Cloudera and DataStax, getting them into the gallery. So I was in the teams that helped that. So I did a lot of early education for a lot of the networking companies that are now virtual appliances. It's nice seeing the big slides of all the companies I work with back then.
Very nice. Now, Cale, you're in DX now, correct?
Yep, I know those companies very well.
That's good. That's great. Okay, so so Neil, I mean, so right now you're helping. What's your role now? Like, what do you?
About a year ago, a year and a half ago, I guess we started the cloud solution architect role to help customers get onto the platform, have a good experience with on the platform. And so I was one of the early cloud solution architects. And since then, it's grown. We've now got a lot more than we had a year ago. And so I typically help a small number of customers and try and ensure they have a good experience and help solve their problems. And don't do the support problems. That's Evan's job. Uh-huh. But we have a good relationship and kind of everyone knows their role. And we try and essentially, it's a one Microsoft story. We're trying to keep going with customers to make sure that their experience is as good as possible.
Now, how do you get involved with these customers to start with? Like, how do they connect with someone like you, like a CSA?
Typically, it's coming through. We have a fairly precise list of customers we work with, but typically things like the account managers will try and get us involved in their customers, that kind of thing, or people reach out if they could help. And, it's usually through things like that. Other than our kind of defined list of customers we tend to work with, which is a fairly small set. But we will help. We will pitch in and help other accounts, account managers, and stuff with our customers when necessary.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Neil, from my perspective, right? Because I, you know, again, I work with a lot of you guys as CSAs. You know, where you're working with a customer and then they're having trouble, right? And then with the support case, my perception of where you guys kind of play really, really well is you're kind of going to come in and give somebody that kickstart so that they kind of maybe have this vision, but they don't quite know how to get from where they are to where they want to be in Azure. They know all these, you know, cool services we have, but like how they decide, do I use, you know, table storage or blob storage for fill in the blank? You guys kind of come in with that ready-made knowledge and help them accelerate that
yeah,
move.
Exactly.
Is that kind of a reasonable description?
Yeah, exactly. So, Jim, we'll help them, especially in the early days, we'll help understand, we'll talk to them and find out what they want to do, and then we'll try and work out how they can best do that in Azure. Sometimes it's getting them not to do things. And so we're very much a sort of architecture, features and functions, how best to use them. And then when there's support issues, the support guys will take over and maybe work with us, with the customers. So we often end up working with support together with the customers and sometimes an intermediary between the customers and support teams when there are big issues.
Okay. So, you know, you've been involved since the early days. And how do you see, What's your take on the current maturity of Azure, just in general? I mean, I know we started in early days when I think we all know it was probably a kind of an immature cloud-based system. We just had PaaS to start with, and then we had IaaS, and now we have all the other features. What's your just on a very high level? What's your take on the maturity in Azure today?
I think it's obviously way more than it was 8 years when it was first getting going, but it's, I think more important than just maturity is just the momentum is phenomenal at this point in time. Three, four years ago, if you looked at, say, Twitter sentiment on the cloud, the sort of the cloud experts that are all over Twitter, they would talk about the cloud being AWS and Rackspace and sort of OpenStack and various other companies, and they would never mention Microsoft, whereas now it's pretty much a given that AWS is there and Microsoft is there and Google's there, and at least in the public cloud, there's not really much else. There's things like DigitalOcean for a lot of developers, individual developers like DigitalOcean at the very low scale, where we're not necessarily competing at that level with them.
Right.
But it's really that kind of the Twitter sentiment and the kind of the cloud sentiment now is there's really just two or three major hyperscale companies that are going to dominate the business.
Right. I think it's fair to say that Azure is kind of like a household name these days, whereas just a few years ago, no one heard about it.
Absolutely. Even though there was no reason for no one to have heard about it, it was just kind of the industry had kind of turned against Microsoft, I think, 3 years ago, because it was pretty obvious even 3 years ago that it was going to be successful. Microsoft had the money to make it successful, had the experience to make Azure work, and it was just a question of time until that happened. And I think we've seen that time has happened, and the momentum we're getting from new features and on a weekly, daily basis is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, and I think part of this, Neil, I mean, like, for, you know, again, from my perspective as the support folks, right, or support person, I mean, what I see is that we shifted to kind of line up with the rest of the industry as far as, hey, it's not just Microsoft, not closed source is not the word I want, but you know, Microsoft developed software. It's making sure that people can come and do whatever they want in the Azure world, I think, is part of what helped that flip, right? Because it used to be if you weren't kind of the Microsoft stack, SQL and Windows and .NET, then there was this perception. And PaaS kind of drove it that way, right? Because that's what you could do in a PaaS world, or the early on PaaS world. You know, as we started moving to IaaS, at the same time we took this flip and said, oh, yeah, you know what, sure, run on Linux VM, sure, run, you know, run your own Redis stuff here, you know? So I think that's part of what drove that as well.
Absolutely. And in the PaaS cloud services days, it was very much a greenfield environment. And greenfield is not the right place for everyone. Not everyone can do a greenfield thing. You sort of brownfield migrations, etc. And so that just that IaaS helps there, because it's just pushing with just one PaaS cloud service, it's hard because you only talk to people doing new stuff and it's challenging. And there's, I think, just now that this sort of the industry, the CIOs have got to the point where they're all starting to think we have to have a cloud story. So it's not 3 years ago we might be telling people what the cloud is and the value of it, whereas now they understand they have to have a cloud story just for their own job security. Mm-hmm. And that's been a big change, that people are starting to come out of the woodwork saying we need some story here, help us.
Yeah, the one thing, Neil, I was interested what you run into and when you're out there is, you know, like you mentioned IaaS quite a bit, like, you know, because it's pretty flexible because people kind of get what that is. They understand how to manage because they've been doing that for some time, even maybe on premises. But are you seeing any kind of shift with like these container-based workloads now to more of a PaaS type model, or still seeing people saying, no, we'd rather stick with IaaS and we'll go with that, and then maybe they'll slide into PaaS a little bit, or are you seeing any crossover there at all?
Yeah. I think it's really the customer base. I mean, most of the customers I'm working with are really kind of more lift and shift deployments. Other people I work with are they're doing new deployments and they're looking at things like Service Fabric, especially in the Windows platform. Mm-hmm. One of my immediate peers who got several customers looking at Service Fabric pretty actively. So that's more than, say, containers. And other people are starting to look at containers. But the container world, I think, is still fairly messy for large-scale production deployments. Mm. There was a big DL thread yesterday about Docker networking. What does it mean and how does it work? And things like that. The whole orchestration space there is still pretty pretty nebulous, and kind of it's do you use Mesos or do you use Kubernetes or do you use Docker Swarm or what do you use? So I think the Docker world itself is in some turmoil there in terms of orchestration. How do you manage a bunch of containers? Mm. So if you want to start something new, how do you do it?
Yeah, I see the same. It's like, you know, we have this ACS service that we have, and they're like, what is that? Like, how does it, and is that the same as Service Fabric? You know, so I was wondering if you get those same kind of questions, like, what the heck is this?
And so I think that's why perhaps in some of our customer base, Docker hasn't been taken off quite as much as it may be in some brand new startups are looking at it. But I think even for high scale stuff, the whole Docker orchestration thing is still fairly iffy.
Now, you said lift and shift is what you do a lot, Neil. I know lift and shift sounds like it's real, you know, simple, but I'm sure it's not. What are some of the scenarios in lift and shift? Are these like entire front to back workloads, like front end, middle tier, back end, and complete lift? Is it a hybrid scenario where they lift and shift part of their tiers, or what are you seeing out there?
It's sort of a lot of people starting to look at just, they want rid of their data centers. Hmm. So they're in some, and they just want rid of everything. They want everything to move into the cloud. And it's a question of how can we best do that with stuff that wasn't necessarily built with a cloud first idea. I mean, there's no design for failure in the original design. So taking account of that, but you know, one of the customers are looking at now, they have got multiple data centers and they're thinking to move, they would like to move them all somewhere else, and hopefully into Azure's where we'd like them to get to. But so it's a question of working, looking at what they have and saying, what's the best way to move this in? How can we best migrate it? And does Azure Site Recovery work for them or not? That kind of stuff. So having essentially platform features like Azure Site Recovery to help with that migration in the long run with them would likely make a big difference, rather than just copying files from somewhere to somewhere else manually.
So how do you approach a typical customer like this, just at a very high level? Like, what are some of the things you need to find out from the customer, or what are things some of the things they can do to be better prepared to do such a migration?
I think from our perspective, we just try and understand what the workloads are and what the capabilities and the characteristics of the different workloads are. Things like just operating system at a basic level. We don't necessarily support all operating systems. Red Hat 5, for example, can be challenging because it's not supported by either Microsoft or Red Hat in Azure. Things like that. So just understanding what they've got and what limitations they may cause in the platform. They may want, for example, they may run a single box that is critical to their service, and that's not necessarily the best way to run it in any cloud, having a single server that's central to the service that can't be duplicated or replicated in any way. Things like that, trying to identify blockers, trying to work way around the blockers is what we do a lot of.
Now, do you take advantage of things like scale sets and stuff like that as you move into the cloud? Is that something that comes up?
So things like scale sets for migrations is actually quite hard because a lot of on-premises applications aren't built to be scaled out in that way. And they often are just, let's buy a bigger server and run with a bigger server rather than scale it horizontally. And that's one of the benefits of being cloud first is you can deliberately plan to use things like scale set to do scale out rather than kind of the on-premises scale up.
Right.
That's one of the major challenges is the software is not necessarily built to run in the cloud, given the sort of fragility of the underlying infrastructure.
Yeah, I'm wondering too, the other thing that I've run into quite a bit and see if you have the same is around, especially when you're doing a migration. So if somebody says, hey, I have, these hundreds of servers running on premises right now, and I can manage them, I do all my things, and then they'll say, I want to take this one app or this set of applications, I'm going to move them to the cloud. But typically the challenge there is around management, right? So they have a bunch of management and logging tools and all that stuff built. Are you seeing the same thing, or are you seeing them saying, well, when I go to the cloud, I'll use cloud-based kind of logging, and we'll basically have two panes to manage versus trying to do like a hybrid and connect the two worlds kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the things that comes up. And one of the customers I work with, they did a lot of stuff on-premises, they did a lot of stuff in Azure, and they wanted to, one of the teams of love, just a single pane of glass to manage both. And this before the days of Azure Stack, when Azure Stack at least gives you the portal looks identical between Azure Stack for on-prem and Azure in the cloud. So that's nice that it's identical. But they were actually, the particular sort of team was looking for just, they want to be able to do either location from a single pane of glass, essentially. At least we're most of the way there with Azure Stack, Azure Stack portal.
And Neil, how do they handle like Active Directory on premises? Are they comfortable moving that to the cloud, or is that something that's still seen as very sensitive?
Well, I think because of Office 365 is really the big leader there, so that's often the first question we'll ask when talking to a customer about Azure: are you on Office 365? Because if you're on Office 365, you already have Azure Active Directory out there, and you're likely already syncing with your Active Directory on-prem. So that's more than half the battle in terms of getting the sort of administrative users into Azure, into a form we can use them in Azure without doing any other work. Having Office 365 and that syncing that exists already is a phenomenal benefit.
But if they don't have it, or for some reason they don't have Office 365, is that something in the plan that you put out there first?
Yeah, well, obviously to run Azure, you obviously have to have an Azure Active Directory, and so it's just an extra step that we have to sort of educate the customers on what that means and building out a directory there and how to manage it, get all the RBAC benefits, etc. Some places may proxy through a single sign-on through someone else, typically, most of the customers have Office 365 and already have Azure Active Directory, so it works pretty nicely from that perspective. And if they don't have it, we can just do a cloud-only Azure Active Directory.
Well, and Neil, I suspect you guys are, I mean, Office 365 and Azure kind of go to a different need in the market. But at the end of the day, kind of like you were talking about, like Azure Active Directory, there's a huge overlap in terms of, you know, customers using both and kind of using them in combination. You know, maybe using your MFA with your Azure stuff, and that's kind of an O365 piece, or, you know, or you're using, you know, ExpressRoute for Azure, and then you add in the Microsoft peering, you know, for O365. Right, so I mean, I got to think that these days you guys are more and more walking in saying, okay, you want to take advantage of the cloud, and you're less focused on what's, it's not just like a straight Azure implementation necessarily anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's all one cloud, the Microsoft cloud, whether, I mean, it's, I'm not going to tell someone to run Microsoft Exchange in Azure, even if it gets, you know.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're a good
That's
man,
all
Neil.
Was after. He just wanted to get that on record. That's all.
But even if it deploys VM stuff, it doesn't buy it. I mean, it's good for Azure consumption, but it's not good for the cloud in general. I mean, it's like, there's no reason to do it. So, you know, I would always direct someone to Office 365. So to me, it is all one big Microsoft cloud there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way, and thank you again for plugging that. I'll ship you the $20 in the mail. but yeah, no, I mean, I think Sujit and Kale, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but like I hear that more and more from customers. They're asking, you know, when I run into them, they're asking about stuff, and they don't really make a big distinction between the two.
Right.
They're talking about Power BI, and then the next breath they're talking about, well, and now I'm running, you know, my ADFS servers in Azure. Like, they just kind of whatever they pick and choose what they need, right? And it's just Microsoft Cloud.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if it still happens now, but it used to be for me. That was kind of, Office 365 was like the gateway drug. It was like, you know, that was the no-brainer. Like, it worked you know, you could just plug into that. People got comfortable with that, and then they started thinking about the applications for Azure, and then, you know, these things kind of integrate really nicely.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the one, and I'm guessing since our name is the Azure Podcast, I'm gonna take a guess that we don't have a ton of Exchange admins, you know, that are in our audience. If you're here at an Exchange admin, great, power to you. But, you know, there's not a whole lot of people in the world that want to install Exchange. Right? They want their email, right? You know, so they don't really want to stand up a bunch of Exchange servers and administer that. They want their email.
Now, Neil, in this lift and shift world, what makes a lift and shift more complex than, say, another easier lift and shift? Like, why are some of the, I've heard stories that some of these can be very challenging. What makes them challenging?
From my perspective, it is really things like unsupported operating systems and stuff like that. It's the tricky ones I've come across, that it's that just makes it awkward. And if you get single points of failure, that a VM or a server has to be running or things go bad. That's historically been the other bad one that I've come across in terms of helping people understand how to run in Azure.
But what that does is just the same kind of quote-unquote crap running on-premises will also be running in the cloud, correct?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, that's what happens, except on-premises typically is more robust than any cloud. I mean,
that's interesting. Why do you say that?
Well, what AWS showed, and actually what Google showed in like 2000, when Google went public in 2000 or whatever, 1999, people said, were shocked that Google had 100,000 really cheap servers. But what that showed was that the most cost-effective way to get large-scale compute was to use really low-cost servers, but just use a lot of them. And if something happened to them, just get rid of them and have a new one, whole pets and cattle thing, I guess.
Yeah.
But Google really demonstrated almost 20 years ago, the benefit from a cost perspective of using ultra low cost hardware and scaling out horizontally instead of ultra expensive hardware scaling up. Like, I went to a talk and it was like a panel discussion, and Mark Kuban was there and someone from another company was there. It was just after Kuban had sold his company to Yahoo for, I don't know, $5 billion or something. And the guy from the other company said, you could have bought one of our big servers and just run the whole thing. Instead of your 100 PCs running broadcast.com, you could have run one of your big servers, and that would have been just one box. I said, yeah, but I couldn't afford the big box. I could afford 100 PCs.
Interesting. Okay, so that's one of the complexities is moving that. Now, what happens if you do run into a situation where you have an unsupported operating system? Do you say, no, you can't do it, or do you do it anyways?
Well,
Wait a minute, can I answer that?
yeah, Evan's gonna say,
oops,
wait
I'm
a
sorry,
second.
I didn't realize Evan was on.
We would encourage them to move on to supported operating system because it makes everyone's life easier if we can get things into a supported state.
Okay, so that's the complexity. You got to upgrade the operating system or more, change it to a supported version as part of the migration. Okay. Right. What else makes things? How about things like networking? Any odd networking configurations and things like that, or databases? Do they make things any more less complex?
I think some of the networking stuff and the administration, I mean, a lot of on-premise IT guys are used to doing things in a certain way, and it's got to be that way. So it's a question of helping them understand why it is different in the cloud than it is on-premises. You're more limited in what you can do just because on-prem you can do whatever you like, you can buy whatever hardware you like, and in Azure you can't do that. And so it's a question of helping them understand how they can do what they want within the constraints of Azure. But then you get all these additional benefits if you do that.
I think that's probably the part, Neil, that I find the second half of your statement is the one that I actually find the richest conversations around. Because, like, everybody kind of gets, okay, I'm going to move to Azure or move to AWS, and I'm not going to quite have the, you know, I can't, like, say I want N memory and Y, you know, CPUs. I kind of have this subset that I can pick from, right? But I think they forget about the fact of, in the on-premises world, you know, if I bought my hardware, that's my hardware. I'm done. Right, that's what I'm stuck with for how many years, right? Until it depreciates down. In Azure, if you go, holy crap, I need bigger hardware. Scale it up. Holy crap, I overbought this month. I'm gonna scale down. Scale it down. I mean, like that's so. I mean, like I find some people sometimes get so hung up on the limitations of what I'm gonna lose, they don't see the second half of that conversation.
And I think it was when the days when we're so. With sort of cloud native platform as a service situation, you would say, okay, the hardware is somewhat more fragile in the cloud than it is on-prem. So you design things to scale out. So you get benefits of scaling out in that now it's highly available because instead of having one box that has to be available come what may, you can run on 10 boxes, and if one of them's down, you've only lost 10% of your service. So you can kind of turn this into a positive in going cloud native. By just making things actually much more available, even in the presence of the underlying fabric is less available individually.
Yeah,
I
totally agree. Yeah.
I think back to the networking thing, and I think Evan even had this in one of his slides. I seen him present one time was around things not to do about networks, and it was like, you know, some people who've been doing, you know, networking on premises for 20 years. You know, they have these ways of like, this is the way I'm going to cut my network up, and I do this exactly. I want to keep my broadcast domain small and all this kind of thing. And then they move to the cloud, and you're like, don't make them so tight. You know, give yourself a little bit of room there because it's like the same situation as what you were on premises.
Yeah, because we have all these virtual networks and whatnot, right, that we set up in Azure. And we've got certain subnet rules and things around that, don't we?
I mean, to some extent. I mean, I think where customers make a mistake is they. I'm trying to think of the best way to say it without, because I don't want it to come across negative, is that there are absolutely some limitations in Azure today around like the flexibility of once I've designed my network, adding more IPs to that subnet or whatever, just because there's some limitations. Those will go away at some point, but. You know, people are saying, "Hey, I'm gonna deploy this little workload." That, you know, they're thinking the scale up mentality. Hey, my deployment or my workload is 5 servers, so you know what? I'm gonna set my environment up for 7 servers just in case I need a couple more. And then they realize, "Hey, wait a minute! I'm not stuck to just one IIS server. I get this load balancer thing comes for free, and well, maybe I'll do 4 web servers because now I have some extra redundancy and I can do a traffic spike." And then they run smack up against, oh, well, wait a minute, I only allocated 8 IPs for this subnet, right? So just, you know, give yourself that flexibility to grow, you know, again, and if you're not tying this stuff back to your on-premises network, there's no reason to conserve these, right? It's only when you're tying back to your on-premises that you can't overlap and that kind of stuff. And that does get really interesting and complicated. But if you're not integrating this with your on-premises workload, give yourself 5,000 IPs. What's the downside?
Yep. There's nothing to lose there. And I just want to ask Neil one more thing. Neil, I know you also have a lot of experience on the storage side, right? Besides compute,
Yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to share about your storage experience? What do you see? What should customers be avoiding, and what should they be focusing on when it comes to storage and migrating to Azure?
I think in general, one of the things people forget about, everyone looks at the IOPS and the throughput of standard storage and premium storage, but I think the real thing to look at is actually the latency, because that can get you out of a lot of trouble just having low latency. And premium storage is very low latency, whereas standard storage is doesn't. You know, it's like an order of magnitude different. And I think a lot of the challenges people have is to do with latency. They might think it's IOPS or throughput, but it's actually the underlying latency. And so you should pretty much for any real workload, significant workload, look at premium storage first, because having that low latency a lot of trouble.
And that's for the
That's
local drive, right? You're talking about on the
no,
on the VMs.
that's for pre no, that's for premium storage, for
Oh.
remote storage. So I was looking at premium storage for data workloads,
Oh,
because
okay.
millisecond latency is a lot better than having tens of millisecond latencies for any operation. And so I know everyone focuses on the IOPS, like 500 IOPS per disk or whatever for standard storage, but they should really be focusing on the latency. And that drives you towards using premium storage pretty much everywhere.
That's a good tip. Very good.
Very.
How do you usually, Neil, just to dive a little bit into that, how do you usually approach that? Like, 'cause some people that I've talked to, they don't really even understand like what IOPS loads they need. They just have a general sense. They're like, well, this isn't really that heavily loaded, so we'll put it on standard storage. Do you have ways to kind of deal with that, or how do you kind of approach that when you say, actually, let's look a little bit deeper at that. Maybe you need to be using premium storage, or how do you approach that?
Yeah, I always try and get people to actually do testing with their workloads to see what it is. I've worked with one customer, they spent months and months. It was a data storage company. So they actually spent a lot of time testing what was the best size of VMs to use to get the best throughput for the cost they were willing to sort of accept. But always testing. You should always test these things whenever you're looking at performance, because it is different in cloud than it is on premises. I mean, the latency adds things, the IOPS adds things, etc. And you should definitely always actually test fairly realistic workloads.
So, question about that, Neil, and this is something that I've always struggled with. In the on-premises world, the hardware I'm running on today is different than the hardware I'm running on tomorrow, and my two, my disaster recovery machines are probably not the same as my, everyday machines. And so that testing becomes really critical to make sure that that hardware can do it. In Azure, there's kind of this law of averages in that. On any one day, because it is a multi-tenant world, I might see a slightly different performance profile of a D2, for example. But on average, everybody's going to see the same general performance from a latency and a storage performance perspective from those workloads. Do you find that people sometimes maybe overthink how unique their workload might be and overtest, or do you think that's you don't see anybody go, you don't typically see people go that far?
Yeah, I don't usually see people over testing. I mean, there are certain pathological workloads that have problems with high latency storage. Azure storage really requires, especially standard storage, really requires high queue depths. It's got to have a lot of parallel operations because of the latency. And if you've got there are some kind of just pathological existing applications that essentially do sequential writes or sequential reads. They behave particularly badly, and there's almost no way around that if the software's already there and you've got no choice about it. And that's when you've got to look at things like premium storage to see if reducing the latency of these things makes a difference. People typically aren't over testing unless they actually come across a problem like that. And then they start, what's the best way to get around that problem?
No, yeah, good point. No, good point.
Right. That's some good tips over there, Neil. Thank you very much for that. Well, I think we've really gone pretty long on this particular episode. I don't want to keep Neil there all evening. He's on the West Coast there, and want to give him some of his time back. Anything else that we have for Neil?
No, this is great, Neil. Thanks to I think this is the first time in all these years we've actually been on a call together. So, no, it's nice to actually talk to you in person.
Yeah, and you.
Yeah, thanks for joining, Neil. This was very valuable. I think the listeners will get a lot from this.
Thanks for having me on.
Anytime. All right, guys. Thanks a lot, Cale and Evan.
Yep, thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.